It's not peculiar to any given behavior. The values are peculiar. You specify a value here. There's just enough logical difference, so it would be awkward to just add a reason parameter. Say. In point of fact, if you get this parameter, you will encompass the reason. So because if the significance of obeying the sergeant is that I'm doing what is right, then the fact that I chose the obedient behavior on the ethical basis will show up in the description of the significance. So in that sense, the fact that reasons are very close to being parameters of behavior gets shown in the fact that here you incorporate the information. On the other hand, for purposes of use, we often want to identify the reason per se. And that's why this kind of notation.
There's a hierarchy there. It's resembles Maslow's hierarchy.
Perish the thought.
I was referring that you're putting a value on these.
No.
But I wonder if your hierarchy, if there's a hierarchy, or are those categories by accident?
They're not by accident, and there's no intrinsic order. You might say this is a statistical order. If you ask people to think of reasons, this is the usual order in which they come out. As most people think of pleasure, pain first, and then something to do with potential, quickly followed by this, and then after some time period, some of these. And you can easily perform that experiment in a lab where you have people who you can ask the question to, and I think you'll find this fairly regularly. If you're dealing with a group, if you're dealing with an individual, no, some will think of these first, etc. And here again, it's simply a combination of history and convention, since when we first started working, it came out in this order. Ever since then, I've been writing them down in that order. Occasionally, I slip up and write them down in a different order. And keep in mind, there is no intrinsic order, there is no hierarchy. I think we showed that by showing that you could take each of them and say all the others are special cases of it. So there's no hierarchy built into these. Or the. Okay, consider this then a more complete form of representation of a deliberate action. Now, let's perform some deletion operations on this. Keep in mind, we have first put in all of this stuff. And keep in mind that when you have a deletion operation, you don't take it that the things you're not talking about are not there. It's just that you're not talking about them. So if we delete this, and this, and this, and this, we're left with an achievement description. However, it's the achievement of a deliberate action based on this kind of choice. And now, this one, let's delete everything again, and you have another achievement description. And the achievement description is also that of a deliberate action, but without necessarily this. And now let's take it that this action represents the giving of the description by the observer. This action consists of something that you would put in quotes, namely, he says, he's sitting in a chair. So the description, he's sitting in the chair, or rather giving that description, is this action. And the critic considers the giving of this description as a choice of behaviors, that the observer chose to give this description and to engage in that behavior, in contrast to any of the other behaviors he might have engaged in. But he's only interested in the result, namely, what description did he come out with? He is not interested in the motivation, the skills, etc. He's just interested in what description he came out with. And he contrasts or compares this with this. Namely, the description that he would have come out with if he were picking descriptions on the basis of this intellectual standard. Which is to say, if he were picking descriptions on the basis of truth. Because keep in mind that you can pick descriptions on some other basis. You can pick descriptions on the basis of convenience, on the basis of whether it would be to your self-interest, basis of whether it would produce pleasant results, or on the basis of whether it's true. So this represents the case where the selection has been based in terms of whether it's true rather than on some of these other possibilities. Now, this contrast or this comparison is what is essential for the critic. So we say, in the critic's behavior, this is what he is distinguishing. The critic needs to be able to distinguish this kind of behavior from other kinds. And that's what is essential to him as a critic. Now notice that we're only dealing with achievement descriptions, which means that the critic who asks, but is it true? Is not engaged in trying to read your mind. He is not engaged in diagnosing why you said what you did. What he's asking is, does your product measure up to a certain criterion? Namely, is it true? But to ask that question, he has to have the concept of a description which is true, which is responsive to this kind of perspective, and contrast that with some other choice. So, did you have a question?
No, I'm just going to ask you, distinguishing between a description that's based on the truth and one that's not
right.
Based on your perspective.
See, as I said, if it comes to choosing descriptions, I can choose on some other basis. I can give you a description that isn't true and I know it, but it'll get me something from you, because I can lie to you or I can deceive you. So when you have one that's based on this kind of principle of selection, namely the perspective of fittingness.
But he only has the achievement.
Yeah. That is, the critic needs to himself have the notion of which answer or which description you would get if you were picking this. And then he compares the one that you would get if you're picking on the basis of truth. He compares that with the one that the observer came up with and asks, are they the same? And if they're not, then he says, your description isn't true. If they are the same, he says, your description passes the test. Now, let me warn you, there's nothing in this formulation that says that critics are foolproof. There's nothing that says that if a critic makes this kind of judgment, he's right. We're simply representing a form of behavior that can be engaged in by people. There's nothing that says that when a person engages in that form of behavior, he's doing the right thing. So, is this now, this specification, using this concept that involves these principles of selection, this concept and the contrast or comparison to just any old product, is what the critic needs to be able to distinguish and work with.
think we have an example. Observer, reactor, doing the formulation of the two achievements of the same critic value, same in one case it is, in one case it isn't.
Well, look, suppose that I say he's sitting down in a chair. You look over there, you say, how would one describe that behavior if one were picking on the basis of truth? And you may have half a dozen descriptions, all of which, as far as you can see, are true. And then you compare that with the one that I gave, and you say, by God, that's one of them. So he's giving me the kind of answer or the kind of description that you would get if you were picking him on the basis of truth. On the other hand, if I said he's standing on his head, you looked over there and said, how would one describe his behavior if one were choosing descriptions on the basis of accuracy or truth? You look down your list and say, gee, that's not one of them.
Maybe incorrect.
Yeah, you say, that's an incorrect description. And then you might ask, why would somebody say he's standing on his head when he isn't? And you might have some explanation there.
As a critic?
No, as an observer describing. See, initially you're operating as a critic to decide whether my description is true or false. As soon as you, as a critic, decide that it's false, you now have a problem as an observer describer. Namely, how come I gave a false description?
And I'm out of the critic role.
And at that point, you're out of the critic role. You're into just the regular observer describer. What was my behavior of giving you that false description? Was it a deliberate action? Or was it merely an achievement, an honest mistake, or what? And that's simply normal description. It's not particularly criticism or appraisal.
Do you mean the critic then becomes the observer describer? If it is true, then you can describe why it is true.
Yeah, but keep in mind, AOC are roles and not people. When you're talking about people, you're talking about somebody who could be doing any of these. And that's why I pulled the switch. I said, at this point, your task is that of a critic, and that's what you're doing. As soon as you finish that task, you've got an appraisal of the behavior, and now you can take that up as an observer describer and try to re-describe that behavior. And that may get you some interesting mileage. See, being able to come up with an account of why I gave you a false description may be of great value to you compared with simply the conclusion that it was a false description. But it's that conclusion that it was a false description that represents your work as the critic.
Need all descriptions be true or false? It seems like those words, the word description, doesn't fit. I can imagine cases where the description being either true nor false.
Can you give me an example?
Let's see. It's hard right now. It's something about truth as a basis.
Well, you may be thinking of this other problem. There's plenty of descriptions that you'll never know, and nobody else ever will, whether they're true or false.
But then, why is it true or false?
Yeah. Well, look, suppose I say right now there's a robin perched up on the roof and it just flew away. Unless somebody happens to be looking there right now, none of us will ever know. On the other hand, it makes perfectly good sense to say, look, either he was there or he wasn't. So that statement is either true or false, whether we know which it is or not. Well, you have your pick. You can make that a matter of definition, and I think I'd refer to it. See, if it's a statement at all, then it's true or false. But then that there's some slack there that I think is what you have in mind. You then have to deal with the fact that not everything that a person says is a statement. And maybe not even some of the things that really sound like statements. But I think it's neater that way than to let yourself in for what is an enormous formal hassle to allow statements that are neither true nor false.
What is the definition of the description of truth?
There isn't any.
Does your behavior measure up in what way?
In this way. See, asking does it measure up in this way is not comparable to saying, did he do the right thing? Does his behavior measure up in this way? See, all of these are bases for choosing, and you can refer to them and ask, was the behavior the one that would have been chosen if you were choosing on this basis? Well, now, clearly, this sort of thing is simply a special case of an observer describer. Because for the observer describer, remember, we said the behavior is verbal and he's using the concept of behavior. Well, here, you see, is the use of concepts of behavior. And here, what he gives is an appraisal, namely, that description is false. And that's certainly a case of verbal behavior. So the critic's behavior of saying that description is true, or it's false, or it's correct, or it's accurate, is a special case of observing and describing behavior.
As long as the critic, you could fail to knew that he was nearly 100% accurate, he's a critic. But as soon as he goes into the postulating of saying, well, he's false because of, then he becomes the observer.
No. Saying it's false because still leaves him as a critic, but you can separate his saying it's false and say that's pure critic, saying because, whatever he refers to under because will be a case of observing and describing.
But he can say it's false and be a critic because of the probability of accuracy?
No. I haven't referred to anywhere along the line here probability.
Okay, but what gives him that? Certain words turn you away.
That's right.
What gives him that?
Right.
What gives him that?
You're right. That was an accurate description. Keep on.
I'm trying to put it away.
Remember, you don't have to read my mind, just talk about products.
Okay, what I'm trying to get at is all of a sudden it comes to mind that a critic is accurate in true and false.
No, I said there is nothing in this formulation that implies that critics are good critics, that their criticism is justified, that it's correct. Any more than there's nothing in the observer-describer formulation that implies that his description is correct or accurate. You can have bad criticism. You can have incorrect criticism. You can have irrelevant criticism. All of these are possibilities. And I'm sure that we encounter them frequently enough to make that non-trivial.
Involve considering the critic as an observer describer and you're in the critic role, making a statement about it.
Yeah. See, if you have an actual critic and you look at what he says, you can simply consider him as an observer describer and yourself act as critic and ask, was that criticism warranted? And you are now operating as a critic and considering him an observer describer.
Can't you see him then as engaging in behavior and seeing him as?
Yeah. Again, you see, particularly if you say that was an inaccurate description, you then consider him as actor and say, what was he doing by giving me an inaccurate? And again, you might have some interesting answers. See, certainly when you're dealing with clients and they tell you things that you think aren't true, one of the first things you do is saying, what's he up to? What's he doing to me? What is he doing by telling me this? What's he doing by doing this to me here now? A lot of questions that you can then move to from that critical basis.
Okay.
is it the role of the observer when someone decides that that was a false description? Or
no, that's a critic.
Doesn't it?
To say that that a description is false is to pass a critical judgment on it.
To ask the question, why did he give me a false description? Is that...
That's observer described.
Because
that's to ask, what was his behavior of which the achievement was giving me a false description?
I guess I've got a sequence of a time question. It seems like somebody does both at the same time.
I've said about actor, observer, and critic that these are roles that a given person can be doing all three simultaneously.
Okay.
And so I want to be careful to keep reminding you that these are roles and not people.
They have to be doing all three simultaneously, don't they? Because observer, describer is a particular, is a specific case of actor, and critic is a particular mm-hmm. case of observer, describer. So that if you're acting as a critic, then you're doing
all three. But you can be an actor without being an observer, describer,
or
critic.
I see. Right.
And you can be an observer, describer,
critic. You have to be doing all three.
Right.
There's a fine point in misunderstanding. That is when you said a person can be doing all three at one time. Are you implying that, yes, a person can do all three at one time, or are you implying that you can describe that person as being, describe that person as doing all three?
Both.
Thanks.
Why do you, the reason I'm asking this is because you have a particular sensitivity about words and choice of words, and perhaps it will help to understand the notion of critic better if you explain why you use the word critic rather than judge. Because that's what he seems to be doing always.
That's one reason for not picking it. We have another place for the term judgment, and that is perfectly general. Keep in mind that in this use, criticism is not perfectly general. As a matter of fact, criticism is a special form of appraisal. And I used the term critic when I'm talking about a description. If I'm talking about a behavior, I will generally use the term appraisal. And that's why in the diagram you have a hyphen, appraisal critic. See, if I look at his behavior and say that was a foolish thing to do, I'm appraising it. But it's a it's a behavior I'm appraising, not a description. And so there I'd say I'm appraising. On the other hand, if I say your description of him is false, I would normally say I'm acting as a critic of your description. And it partly, I think, stems from this, the art critic. Art critics and other art, aesthetic critics are critics of products. See, in this case, what I'm criticizing is your product. And that fits in with that tradition, whereas appraising his behavior is appraisal. Judgment will cover all of these.
So you use the word critic because of the object of the judgment.
That it is. It fits the notion of an art critic and what he does, and the fact that he deals with products, and so it seems natural to speak there of critic.
Final question here. I have one to do, but I'm a little confused. As a scriber, observer, critic is choosing to describe one behavior over another, but as critic, he's opting for one reason over another?
No. As observer, describer, see, that is a fine distinction, because you're talking about the critic as an observer, describer, and also specifically as a critic. You say, as an observer, describer, he's giving an achievement description of this kind of behavior. As a critic, he's comparing the one he got with a hypothetical one that one would get if one were choosing on this basis. So you might say he first has to construct these representations And there he's acting as an observer describer. He has to construct the representation of what the observer describer's behavior was, and then of this hypothetical behavior. Then as a critic, he asks the question, how do they compare? So I think from that you can get a sense of in what sense the observer describer is, the critic is just an observer describer, namely in constructing these, and in what sense he's doing something over and above.
And then a critic looking at him would say he's acting as a critic.
No. Well, no, an observer describer looking at him would say he's acting as a critic. If somebody said his criticism is poor criticism, then that would be another critic talking.
Is that first example of there a hypothetical description of what he did?
Yeah.
It seems like what happens to the critic is that he hears the description books of the world and sees the two meet.
Well, but this is, well, formally it's hypothetical.
But in practice, it's not hypothetical at all.
No. Sometimes you can criticize this on the basis of internal lack of coherence without any independent access to the world.
Then you're not criticizing on the basis of truth, but on the basis of internal coherence.
No, you're saying that since it's internally self-contradictory, it couldn't be the kind of thing that you would pick on the basis of truth. That it's guaranteed to be a bad product. And to say that, you don't have to figure out what would be the right product. See, if I say he's sitting down and standing on his head at the same time, you don't have to know what he's doing to say, uh-uh.
Yeah, most of the time.
But most of the time, the critic has some access, independent access to the phenomena, and that is the basis of his judgment as to the correctness of the description.
He's comparing two observations, his own and the other person's.
No, he's really asking, does his description fit what seems to be the case about the phenomenon?
The only way you have access to what seems to be the case is by observing.
Well, observing, but you know, there's indirect knowledge. Somebody might have told me, or I might have observed something, somebody tells me some other parts of it, and then logically I fit together still other elements, and I have all of that available for checking his description. So you're right, a lot of it is just straight independent observation, but there's in principle more to it.
Would so-called clinical sensitivity be an example that you're talking about?
Yeah. Except keep in mind that example that I gave about the dinner at 8:30, where I said it's not sharp eyesight that comes to your rescue there. Because in terms of eyesight, there's nothing there that looks like hostility. That what you have to know about there is the kind of choices available. Which is to say, you've got to know about some of the things that could have gone on there and didn't. And when it comes to what could have gone on there and didn't, no amount of eyesight is going to give you the answer. So you have independent knowledge. In fact, Gene, there's a good case. Your knowledge of these things is not based on observation, at least not then and there. It's part of your background knowledge of how that sort of thing works. Okay, any other questions about just the role of the critic as such?
Reason solved for the critic to be able to make discrimination, don't you think? That the reasons factor over on that side.
Well, the critic's reasons would generally be these or these.
If he didn't have any reasons at all, it would be a critic.
Right. But if you didn't have reasons at all, you couldn't also be a normal human being. Because you couldn't engage in deliberate action. See, if you couldn't act on reasons, you couldn't make choices, you couldn't be responsible for what you did. And, you know, the world would be vastly different. And it would be so different that we couldn't even say what it would be like.
Could you give a
Some examples will be critic using ethical statements.
Yeah. Remember the case of my telling him that I would bring him the coffee, and then suppose I walk in and don't bring him the coffee, then you as a critic might say he did the wrong thing. He treated him in a shabby way. He broke his promise. And that would be you making an appraisal of my behavior, which is not keeping a promise.
Okay, so in that case, it's an appraisal of behavior, not an appraisal of description of
law. Right.
So
that's why I make the point that you can have appraisal of behavior generally. You can also have appraisal of descriptions, and to separate the two, I use critic and appraiser. A critic is a critic of a description. An appraiser is an appraiser of behavior. And that's a semi-solid convention. I try to use them that way occasionally. I'll slip.
It's still finding it again because it sounded like what was being praised was the behavior, and yet it was a critic making that appraisal.
Well, just think of it as an appraiser doing the appraisal. See, when you say he did the wrong thing in not bringing him the coffee, you're being an appraiser.
Not just an observer.
Right. As an observer, you would say he promised him to bring the coffee and he didn't. As a critic, you say he broke his promise and that was wrong.
As an appraiser.
You see, this part of what gets in the way here is that normally if you said that about me, we would say you were criticizing my behavior. And that's why.
So that's the knowledge of the other options.
Mm-hmm.
But both appraiser and critic are the C rule.
Yeah. See, there's not that much difference. It's a matter of convenience. And it may be that it's more confusing than not to have two terms rather than one.
It's reasonable to say that an observer, describer cannot make judgments about the observation.
Why wouldn't you?
It seems that as soon as a judgment is made, it moves that person's role of appraiser.
No, remember I said judgment is a completely general term, and not all judgments are appraisals. See, the case of somebody who knows what he's doing would be a case of somebody who was an observer. And if he knew that he knew what he was doing, then he would be an observer of his being an observer. It still involves nothing to do with appraisal.
Okay, well then an observer describer cannot make appraisals.
No, remember, appraising is a special case of observing, describing. So whenever you have appraisal being made, that is a case of observation description, but it's a special case.
Okay.
Is it possible to have an ethical reason? Possible for the critic to use an ethical reason without being an appraiser? I'm not confused.
No, if he's a critic at all, he's appraising. So the question of what kind of reasons the critic has for what he does becomes irrelevant. He is appraising. But look, if she says you gave the wrong description, or if she says he broke his promise and that was wrong, her own reason for saying that might be based either on this kind of thing or on this. See, in exposing me as a promise breaker, she might be acting herself on the notion of right and wrong. Or she might just be interested in correcting the record. So when it comes to criticism, as with descriptions, all of these are potentially reasons for engaging in.
Well,
Well, she could also be engaging the criticism because it puts her one up, and that's a nice position to be in, and she enjoys it. So all of those are possible reasons for engaging in criticism, as they are possible reasons for any sort of behavior. Did you have something, Phil?
Yeah, I was just wondering, now, if I describe somebody's behavior as in terms of just whether it's appropriate, and, so, and the critic over here makes, like, for instance, if he's done something that could be considered ethically wrong, and then he says, my description is ill-founded, then he is he's then making an appraisal about the behavior that I was describing.
No, he's making an appraisal of your behavior, saying that your description of him was ill-founded. He's appraising your behavior. Now, to be sure, in making that appraisal, he may need to have some information about the behavior you're describing. Because how else would he be in a position to make that criticism? Very often, if you're dealing with clients, you make this kind of judgment not because you know, in fact, that the behavior that they're talking about didn't occur, but simply because you have a general background that says it's unlikely. That kind of behavior is unlikely to occur, and when he tells me, I just don't believe it. He'll have to show me, or something like that. And of course, you may be wrong, say that. Are there any other questions about the role of critic as such? If not, we'll go to the issue of the fact that the critic could be wrong, and what does he have to help him, not be wrong?
Is there any, has the notion of critic or observer got anything to do with whether or not it's a deliberate action or?
Paradigmatically, all of this is deliberate action. Is that in this paradigm, it's a deliberate action based on this. Here, I said, one takes it that human behavior is deliberate action unless one knows differently. Conversely, or correspondingly, the critic's behavior, you take it as deliberate action that he has chosen to give that criticism as against other things he could have done. So that too fits the fact that if the critic is a human critic, as he must be since he's talking, you take it his behavior is deliberate action unless you know otherwise. So you might say the whole thing involves deliberate action, at least paradigmatically. You see, if the individual was not able to use these notions, why would you accept what he says as criticism? See, if he can't deal with notions of correct and incorrect and right and wrong and true and false, why would anything he says be a criticism of the truth of somebody's statement? You simply wouldn't accept what he says as a criticism. You'd say criticism is a kind of behavior that he doesn't have either the knowledge or the know-how to engage in. And so nothing he does will qualify as criticism of somebody's description. So in general, yeah, criticism is deliberate action, and it involves concepts of deliberate action under achievement descriptions.
When you say you must be human behavior because he's talking, I take it that you don't really mean talking, that you mean conceptualizing, because as you said...
Remember the formula that we gave for verbal behavior, right? Connects talking with conceptualizing.
Okay, what about the person who is evaluating his own behavior? He doesn't say it out loud, but he's conceptualizing.
Mm-hmm.
So to describe conceptualizing, you just delete the elocution.
Yeah. See, that's the thing, that unless there is a way of saying it out loud, nobody has a way of saying what I'm doing in my head when I don't say anything. It's like saying, as long as we know how to do arithmetic on paper, then you can say that somebody is doing it in his head, because you've got a way of saying what it is he's doing in his head. Likewise, if there is verbal criticism of descriptions or behavior, then you can say a person is making the criticism in his head without any visible thing, because you now have a way of saying what it is he's doing in his head. You're usually safer to give those descriptions as achievements rather than as speculations of something going on in his head. Anything further here? Well, as I said, the next consideration is, are appraisers and critics purely and simply at the mercy of the world, or do they have any safeguards and guidelines to help prevent error? And here we can say, yeah, there are some fair number of safeguards and guidelines based on internal coherence. The way it works is this, that since behavior is a complex concept, since the concept of behavior and person is a complex concept, the occurrence of a particular behavior is a complex occurrence. Being a complex occurrence, it can be analyzed into some number of distinct facts. It's a single phenomena, but you can formulate it as some number of distinct facts. Therefore, the statement or the fact that a given behavior has occurred is equivalent to, is identical with, the occurrence of some number of other facts. Take it as an example, the issue of an airplane flying over the hill. See, there's a single fact, the airplane flies over the hill. And then think to yourself what a complex thing an airplane is, what form of event flying over the hill is, at least when you're talking about airplanes, and think how many facts have to be the case for it to be the case that an airplane is flying over the hill. There's all kinds of facts involved in an airplane flying and flying over the hill. Now, because of that, you can check the one description, the airplane flies over the hill, by looking for each of those facts that would constitute the airplane flying over the hill. For example, if I say the airplane is flying over the hill and you look at there and you say, but there's nothing there. See, that's one possible check. If there is an airplane flying over the hill, there is an object over the hill. If you look and see no object over the hill, you say that description is false. Or you look and see an object, but you say, hey, you're wrong. That's not an airplane. That's a balloon. Why? Because airplanes have to have certain kinds of structures or they're not airplanes. So by saying there's an airplane flying there, I'm committed to there being the right kind of thing over there. And if you look and don't see that kind of thing, again, you say, that's wrong. There's something there, but it's not an airplane. Or you look down and you say, well, you're right, there's an airplane and it's flying over there, but there's no hill underneath. So it's not an airplane flying over a hill, just an airplane flying over empty ground. You see, there's all kinds of facts that are implied in that original description that can, because you can establish those kinds of facts separately and independently, you can use those others to check on the accuracy of your original description. And it is a coherence type thing. You look at various facts that are implied by an airplane flying over the hill, and you say, well, do they all fit together in the right way? If they do, then you say, so far as we can tell, yeah, there's an airplane flying over the hill. If something doesn't fit, then either you say, no, there isn't an airplane flying over the hill, or it's up for grabs because something doesn't fit, but it's not clear whether it's just that we don't have enough facts, or whether, in fact, it's not a case of an airplane flying over the hill. Now, what you're not engaged in doing is ever settling without any possible doubt that there's really an airplane flying over the hill. What you're doing is simply incorporating all of the relevant facts and ask, do they all fit with this description? Are they all compatible with that description? If they're all compatible with that description, then up to this point, that description stands. But you may, in the next minute, find some new information that leads you to withdraw it. So you can hardly ever be sure. You certainly don't ever have a guarantee of being correct.
When I'm looking for something, I have a picture in my mind.
Careful. Picture in your mind.
Well, that's if I'm looking for a nail.
Well, try saying you know what you're looking for, or you know what it would look like if there was one there, or something like that.
The whole
idiom of having pictures in one's mind leads almost inexorably to the notion of matching what's here with what's in here, and then one has to ask, how does the matching get done? And the answer is there is no way, because that's not what's going on. If you had to do it that way, it'd be impossible. You don't match an external thing with an internal thing. Instead, you say, if there were one there, I could tell it. And so when I look, if it looks right, then it looks like there is one. And that's what you have to go by. Not an internal picture, but the fact that you have that ability. You would know it, you would be able to recognize it if it was there. And so then all you have to do is look, and there's no matching. Well, notice that's a simpler account too. There's not some mysterious mental process of matching.
It does seem that some people do more kind of visualizing than other people. For instance, if you said nail, and you had everybody draw their, you know, when it's the, you probably get different things. That seems like a picture.
Okay, now look. Suppose I tell you inside this bag is a nail, and then I ask you to visualize, or ask any of you who did visualize to draw that inner picture. And suppose that five of you do that, and I get five different pictures. And then I ask you to look. It could easily be the case that the nail there doesn't look at all like your pictures because it's bent badly out of shape. And every one of you would recognize that was a nail. Now, since it didn't match your picture, one would expect that you'd say, no, there isn't one. But in fact, you'd recognize it right off.
Yeah. I'm not
See, it isn't that you have a picture of a nail and this matches it.
I guess I'm asking less about that kind of question of what it is that people, you know, there seems to be some basis for people thinking that way.
Although, yeah, there's a basis, and people have imagery. What I'm saying is that the imagery is irrelevant. Yeah. In principle, it's irrelevant. In fact, it may help you. It may tune you up. But think how life would be if, in fact, you had to match an inner picture with the actual thing. See, you can't have a single picture that will encompass all of the range of possibilities of there being a nail in.
So you're talking about when people make descriptions, or as you referred to what she said, know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
That they have, I guess in your terminology, parameters.
Right.
That there would be an aspect of the nail that it would have to be a certain material, otherwise it wouldn't qualify as a nail.
A certain shape,
be a certain shape and
right.
size,
yeah.
and things like that.
But also paradigmatically, because if I had the nail all bent up, it wouldn't be the kind of shape that you think of when you think of a nail, but you'd certainly recognize it as a nail that's been bent.
Well, it falls within limits.
Let me give you an even stronger example. Suppose I say, I'm going to write a number on the board, and now you visualize a number, and then I write a number. Would this number have to be the same as the one you had in your head for you to recognize it as a number? No. Neither could you possibly have images of all possible numbers. Okay? You just couldn't. So again, it's simply a way of reminding you that things just don't work that way. You do not recognize things by having the inner image and then comparing. So.
Would the error that she almost made be similar to say, a situation whereby I am describing, I'm telling someone that iron doesn't float in water, and therefore a nail wouldn't be found floating in the ocean. And this person conjured up an image saying, imagine a nail is floating. Imagine that there is a nail floating. Then he conjures up a hypothetical contradiction to mine. Is that kind of a similar error in logic as far as matching goes?
No. To begin with, the person might be right. You can imagine a hollow nail floating. But no matter what they imagine, you can imagine a different case of a nail floating. And so, again, and if you can imagine it, presumably he'd be able to recognize it if he saw it. So, again, it would be the case that he wouldn't have to have the image of it ahead of time.
Either way, you're getting away from the facts when you're talking like that.
Yeah.
This question has had a lot of fun reasons and sad reasons. How would you go about convincing a paranoid that someone that's following him? In the facts, from his perspective, the facts are, when you think someone is following, someone is behind him. The fact is, when he's alone or she's alone, I think she is a better, maybe a good example. She's alone in the house, the phone rings, you get some obscene phone calls, or the door closes without anyone being there. Those are facts. And it could be made compatible with belief that someone is following this particular person.
Mm-hmm.
How would you handle that, say clinically, that type of a case of paranoia?
Well, you get into a bind trying to answer questions like that. And the kind of bind is comparable to your asking me, look, suppose you have a multiplication problem and you're multiplying a three-digit number by a five-digit number, how do you solve it? Well, I can't tell you, and nor can anybody else. Because the proper answer is, well, it all depends on what the particulars of the case are. And in when you give me some information to set up a certain situation, in general, the answer will be, well, it all depends on what the other particulars of the case are, because depending on what the other facts are, you either wouldn't try to handle it at all, or would handle it one way, or would handle it another way. Which is to say that clinical problems are like arithmetic problems. Namely, in general, you have to solve them in the absolute concrete case, because there are no general solutions. And if you have the actual two-digit number and five-digit number, you can multiply it. But if you just say, if you have a two-digit one and a five-digit one, how do you multiply? What can somebody say?
This particular person, you know, from other facts derived from other situations, maybe a TAT or Rorschach is paranoid.
Mm-hmm.
So that when this person comes to you in therapy, when you're working with the person in therapy, one of the things you look for would be how well the facts jive.
Mm-hmm.
But if this same person went to say to me this, I don't know the person you're carrying on.
Okay,
the person
let me give you the most explicit kind of general answer you can give. Number one, it might be a good idea, if you were going to try it all, might be a good idea for you to come up with an alternative explanation that fits the facts equally well. Because if you don't have an alternative explanation along the lines of you're not being followed that also fits the facts, what are you doing claiming that she's not being followed? Okay. So number one, that's a kind of constraint, maybe. It may be a necessary condition that if you're going to succeed at all, you're going to need to have an alternate story. No, it probably isn't an absolute constraint, because you might also say, well, you can also try to figure out how come she's that afraid, and if you can get her to see the danger as less dangerous, then she'd likely accept an explanation that simply says you're not being followed, because she'd no longer have that kind of motivation. And that would be a possible one. But again, you see, you'd have to exercise a lot of judgment about the particulars as to which, if either of these, you did. And I don't know what, any way of going beyond that without more particulars. In that sense, you usually can say something about behavioral problems, but in principle, as I say, you have to solve them in the completely concrete case. That's one reason why traditionally clinicians out is, well, I'd have to know more about that, or, well, it all depends. That it's not entirely a cop-out. Very often, that's the proper answer. But also, take that comparison. Think of how you solve a multiplication problem with actual numbers there versus having some general principles. And then think of this system as working like multiplication, that you can calculate an answer to a particular problem of what's he doing, what's going on here. But there are no general principles. There's no answer to the question, what do people do when they behave? There's no answer to the question, what do people want? Or what do people know? You know, there's just no answers. But if you ask me, what does he know, we could set about constructing an answer. You said, what is he doing now? There are ways of arriving at an answer. But not, what do people do? So you might say that intrinsically, this is geared to dealing with particular cases in a calculational way, which is what clinicians need. Okay, let's move to the issue of there's no guarantee of being right. So how come a critic can do better than chance? I started out by saying that it's a matter of internal coherence, that since the occurrence of behavior is a complex fact, you can check against particular facts for coherence. Now, this checking against particular facts is normally empirical checking. You find out by observation whether indeed all of the things that are implied, or certain of the things that are implied, you find out by independent observation whether those are true. So this procedure is internal coherence. The principle is internal coherence, but the principle is in general that of empirical checking. Now, it's in this connection that we have a set of principles that are in one of your appendices, and these are maxims. And I think it's the third appendix, if I'm not mistaken. Now, the principle for generating the maxims is comparable. Take the example of the airplane flying over the hill. If I want to say that there's an airplane flying over the hill, and get away with it. I can't say anything that would violate those conditions which would have to be met if there was an airplane flying over the hill. For example, I can't both say there's an airplane flying over the hill, but there's nothing moving up there. So I'm committed to a lot of things, and I can't violate what those things imply if I'm going to have a true description. Now, in the same way, if I say he's engaging in a particular kind of behavior, for example, sitting in a chair, then I can't further say anything that would violate those conditions, which must be the case if what he's doing is sitting in the chair. Now, we had examples of violating. Remember when we were discussing the parameters, I say try saying that he's sitting in a chair and then saying, but he can't tell a chair from anything else and he doesn't know how to sit. You know, adding those clauses is violating the conditions that would have to be met if his action is that of sitting in a chair. Now, we have a more general formulation, but it fits the same sort of notion. If you describe a certain behavior as having occurred, then you are committed to all of the things that must be the case if that's the behavior in question. And therefore, you can't violate those conditions if your description is going to be a true one. So we have these constraints then on how you can go about giving a description of person or behavior and not violate the internal coherence requirement. So you can see that the principles then will simply reflect the concept of person and behavior. Except now, instead of the emphasis being on packaging them in a parsimonious form, what we now emphasize is unpacking in order to have discrete principles that you can use one by one, that you can use separately if need be, to do your checking. Now, the first five maxims are geared primarily to the notion of behavior rather than the notion of person. You're geared here rather than there. Furthermore, they're geared to the various parameters of behavior, as you might expect. I said, now the emphasis is on unpacking some of this stuff. Now, a maxim is a rule of procedure. It's a rule that you follow when you're doing something. As such, a maxim has no truth value. It's something you accept, but you don't accept it as true. You accept it as a way of proceeding. So it's a principle that you follow rather than something you believe as true. Now, in order to try to provide constant reminders of this, I've written the maxims in such a way as to make them sound maximally trivial. So as to not give the impression that I'm being informative, that you're being given facts. But rather they're completely trivial on the order of A equals A. The reason is it's not their function to be informative. These are basic procedural rules. And they have to have the same kind of standing as A equals A. Okay, now the first one is partially geared to this parameter. It says that a person takes it that things are as they seem unless he has reason to think otherwise. And this occasionally causes people problems because part of our mythology, our folklore, is that in scientific enterprise you have to be skeptical. And here, this sounds like you're being credulous, not skeptical. Now, the major justification for this rule of procedure is that's the only one you can do. Any other one, any alternative to this one, will get you into an impossible position. More specifically, try the inverse, try the skeptical version that says, you take it that things aren't as they seem unless you can show that they are. And then ask yourself, could a principle of that sort really be followed? You say, okay, take a given case and you have an observer describer, and that's the description he gives. That's what he takes it things are. And he says, ah, but wait a while. That's what it looks like, but I'm not going to take it that that's the way it is unless I can show that it is. Now, what does it take to show that it is some procedure, and you can call it an experiment. Some procedure that involves further observation, further facts. So you engage in this procedure and it gives you a result. And let's suppose that the result indeed fits. And now you'd be inclined to say, well, it looks like I've shown that this is the way things are. And then it hits you. You say, gee, of course, it only looks like I've shown this, but I'm not going to take it that that's the case unless I can show that that's the case. So I have to engage in a further experiment to show that this one did indeed provide the answer to that question. And so I engage in that experiment and get another result. And let's suppose that this is also supportive. I say, gee, it looks like now I've shown it. I say, no, wait, it only looks like I've shown it. I now have to, and you can see where that one goes. So the result is that if you take a skeptical approach, you'll never be able to have any knowledge, not even the knowledge of the correctness of the skeptical approach, which is to say that that sort of approach is simply not a possibility. Now, given that for background, you come back to the formulation that you take it that things are as they seem, unless you have reason to think otherwise, you say, well, hell, there's all the room we need for skepticism there. Because after all, when we do get skeptical and say, watch out, things are not as they seem, we don't do that out of a clear blue sky. We do it on the basis of other observations that tell us that in these circumstances, the results are likely to be misleading. So when we are skeptical legitimately, it's because we have a legitimate reason. And that's what that principle says, that you take it that things are as they seem unless you have reason to think otherwise. Simply that that's the value of the K parameter of your behavior. See, if I see him sitting in the chair and that's the part of my circumstances that I'm going to act in respect to, then him sitting in the chair is simply the value of K. And that's what I take it, things to be. See, when I, again, recall that the values here are given by states of affairs. His sitting in a chair is a state of affairs. So when I take it that he's sitting in a chair, that state of affairs is the value of this K parameter. Now, when I say a person takes it, I want to be neutral with respect to such terminology as he knows, or he believes, or is certain that, or thinks that, or perceives that, etc. Any of these could be ways of taking it that something is the case. Okay, so that principle is one that you can associate with that value of behavior. Now, the second one is also associated with the cognitive parameter. It says that if a person recognizes an opportunity to get something he wants, he has a reason for trying to get it. And here, by opportunity, I mean that in that situation, the person can get something by doing something he knows how to do. And that's to separate out the notion of a practical or actual opportunity with simply the absence of a logical contradiction. For example, I can say, look, there's nothing to keep you from jumping over that building. So you have an opportunity to jump over that building. I think your normal reaction would be baloney. It's, since it's not something I don't know how to do, just the fact that it's not a logical contradiction doesn't mean I have any opportunity here. So this sense of opportunity is specifically geared to things that the person could actually do, that he knows how to do. And it's in under those conditions that recognizing an opportunity will generate motivation. Now, recall I said that whatever is here is also here. You can't want something you don't distinguish. Well, you might say this puts it even more cleanly. You can't act on a particular want for which you don't recognize an opportunity at that time.
By saying it's geared to those things that you have potential of doing, isn't that involved in each brain?
Well, if you're talking about behavior, it involves all of these. But what these principles are doing, in effect, is explicating these aspects of behavior. See, in the original concept of behavior, they're all tied up in one package. Here, we're separating them out and saying this principle pertains primarily here, and this one does too. The next one pertains primarily here, and so forth.
Did you say that a person only recognizes as opportunities those things which he sees himself as able to do?
No. The phrasing was not quite that. There was no word only in that phrase. It said, if a person recognizes an opportunity to get something he wants, then he has a reason. I didn't say that if he doesn't, he doesn't have a reason. I said, if a person recognizes such an opportunity, he has a reason to try. What I did not say is that if he doesn't recognize an opportunity, he doesn't have a reason to try. It's a little safer the way it's phrased.
Equating an opportunity with a reason.
No, it's not equating an opportunity with a reason. It's saying when you see one, then you have the other. When you recognize an opportunity, then you have a reason. But it's not saying that the opportunity is the reason.
Then
you said you wouldn't recognize it as an opportunity if you didn't know how.
Yeah.
Then why is it not under know-how? Age rather than know. You said you wouldn't think of jumping out of the building unless you knew how.
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't recognize it as an opportunity unless it was something I knew how.
Okay, then why isn't it under the know-how?
You could put it there, but I think it primarily is up here. Because it's talking about what it is you recognize. The elaboration of what it is you recognize refers to here. But basically what you're talking about is the recognition of something, and that belongs here.
What do you mean by elaboration?
Well, if I say I recognize something, immediately you think this. Whatever I recognize involves a distinction I'm making. Then if you specify what it is I recognize, you could talk about anything, including the
you could recognize a game of checkers as a game of checkers without knowing how to play.
Yeah.
Okay.
On the other hand, if you said there's a game of checkers going on, you know, a mile away and it's going to end in 2 minutes, but you've got an opportunity to go over there and watch, again, I'd say no, because I don't know how to get from here to a mile away in 2 minutes. He said 4 minutes.
Okay, something seems peculiar about that, because we're used to thinking of those things as missed opportunities, right?
Well, not if it's a mile away and 2 minutes away.
Or
it's not a missed opportunity, it's just unfortunate that I never had a chance.
Or take the case where you don't have a play, but... You
and somebody offers me a game. Again, it's not a real opportunity to play if I don't know how to play. You can say is I missed something there. It's unfortunate, but not I really had a chance but didn't take it.
What was it you missed? Whose kids? The one where you couldn't get there in time.
Yeah. If I couldn't get there in time, then getting there in time is not something I could do. Therefore, there was no such opportunity. Again, you can choose your terminology either way. I'd suggest that if you included impossible things like that under opportunity, you'd simply need another word to pick out the practical, the actual opportunities.
Take a different one. Take one where it wasn't a matter of you couldn't get there in time.
If it was next door and it was 2 minutes in, I'd say, yeah, I have a chance.
And anything, okay, here, there was a message that you didn't get in time, same sort of thing, but where you could have made it is endless opportunity. Or does it again depend on what you're just describing?
No, it depends on how you formulate it.
Okay.
If you include the giving of the message and the fact that it could have reached me in time, you say there was an opportunity. He could have got it to me in time. If you're talking about me, given the context of receiving the message when I did, then I had no opportunity.
Okay.
See, it's like watching a football game, and with 30 seconds left, the team is behind 40-0. You say they have no chance to win. On the other hand, if you take it all the way back to the beginning of the game and suppose that things could have gone differently, then you say they had a chance to win and blew it. But if you take it at this point, the way things have developed, given that, no chance.
I'm not quite sure about this, but I sort of have a feeling for some sort of aesthetic perspective involved in this in terms of appropriateness and accuracy. I'm not quite sure.
Well, I was going to suggest something of the sort. One way of summarizing this issue of real opportunity is the notion of doable. Unless the behavior in question is doable, I don't have any motivation to try. I think that formulation gets at some of this element of the aesthetic here, is that it's fitting to try if it's doable, but not if it's not. See, because the issue is the fittingness of my behavior to the situation. And my behavior will fit if I try something that in that situation is doable. It will not fit, in an important sense, if I try something that simply is not doable.
And I guess that relates to judgment or appraisal in terms of what the person thinks is doable.
Yeah. You certainly encounter cases where, as far as you're concerned, a person can do it, knows how to do it, would have been able to do it, and he says, I never had a chance.
Or the other way, the grandiose schemes
of some people. Vice versa. Right. That's why I was mentioning if it was four minutes. Okay, I think that's a good enough place to stop, and next time we'll continue with the maxims.